So we're going over Judges, chapters 1 through 10. We'll dig into it some. Open up. This was a wonderful lesson to dig through for me, because I've read through multiple times and not really understood a ton at times, understood some, but Wally and I were talking about, Wally's doing the next half of it in 2 weeks, and there's just so much in this book that applies to us today, applies to us as a nation, and so many other things that are just phenomenal in this book. So we'll jump right in. I've got stuff in here from John MacArthur, from Chuck Smith, from Steve somebody. Use that. So quite a few different commentaries that are part of this. So let's start out. The title, let's get some background on Judges. The title of the book bears the fitting name Judges, which refers to unique leaders God gave to his people for preservation against their enemies. The Hebrew title means deliverers or saviors, as well as judges. The book spans about 340 years. As far as the author of this book, no author is named in the book, but the Jewish Talmud identifies Samuel, a key prophet who lived at the time these events took place and could have personally summed up the era. If we look at 1 Samuel 10:25, I'll read that. Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty, and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. So that's kind of where it's pointed out that the belief is Samuel wrote this book. The background and setting, Judges is a tragic sequel to Joshua. In Joshua, the people were obedient to God in conquering the land. In Judges, they were disobedient, idolatrous, and often defeated. Judges 1 through 3, 6 focuses on the closing days of the book of Joshua. Judges 2, 6 through 9 gives a review of Joshua's death. The account describes 7 distinct cycles of Israel's drifting away from the Lord, starting even before Joshua's death, with a full departure and apostasy afterwards. A 4-part sequence repeats over and over in this phase of Israel's history. First, Israel's departure from God. Second, God's chastisement in permitting military defeat or subjugation. 3, Israel's prayer pleading for deliverance. And 4, God raising up judges, either civil or sometimes local military leaders, who led in shaking off the oppressors. So this is something that repeats and repeats in the book of Judges. Of the judges that arose, 6 of them military judges. And just so we're clear, as you've studied some of the other things, I'll probably get half of the names wrong. So just roll with me as I mispronounce them, or you can jump in. Othniel, Ud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson were the military judges. 2 of the judges were special in significance for the contrast in spiritual leadership. 1, Eli, the judge and high priest, was not a good example, and Samuel, the judge and priest and prophet, was a good example. So the historical themes and timelines, Judges is a thematic rather than chronological. Foremost among its themes is God's power and covenant and mercy in graciously delivering Israel from the consequences of their own failure, which were suffered for sinful compromise. in seven periods of sin to salvation, God compassionately delivers his people throughout the different geographical areas and inheritances which had been given through Joshua. In Joshua 13 through 22 is where all of the land was given out or denoted for the different tribes. The apostasy covered the whole land, as indicated by the fact that each area is specifically identified. The southern area in chapter 3, 7 through 31 of Judges, the northern area of chapter 4, 1 through 5, 31. Central is covered in 6, 1 through 10, 5. The eastern area is 10, 6 through 10, 12, and the western 13, 1 through 16, 31. His power to faithfully rescue shines among the dark backdrop of pitiful human compromise and sometimes bizarre twists of sin, as the final summary in Judges 17 through 21, which Wally will be covering in 2 weeks. The last verse of Judges sums up pretty much the entire account of Judges, which is in those days. This is last verse 21 through 21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own sight. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. You know, is that the day we're living at? As we look at this book, I think it's important to realize that history always repeats itself. Always. We live in a country that was founded on Christian values, Christian principles that are no longer part of the greater society's beliefs or actions. You know, that's where we are today. This is a time right now where we as Christians need to stand strong. And this book of Judges, as I went through it, points out so clearly what happens when a nation turns away from God. And I think that's something that we need to look at as Christians today, as to what we are doing and what we are allowing in our hearts. Chuck Smith wrote through, about this book, through Moses, the children of Israel were led out of Egypt, and God began to form a national identity and began to forge the beginnings of a nation. At the death of Moses, Joshua, who was the servant of Moses, took over and continued to lead the people now into the land that God had promised to their father Abraham. Promised that it should be theirs, that they should inhabit it. And thus God kept keeping his covenant and word to Abraham. They moved in. Now the book of Judges takes up the next period of history. There are some 13 judges over Israel. They became sort of a quasi-leader of Israel. They would judge in the matters of the people. They were leaders, but never fully empowered by the people as rulers. They were an interim period between Joshua and the establishing of a monarchy, at which time Saul became the first king over Israel. So this book of Judges covers this period of time between the death of Joshua and the coming of Samuel, who was the final judge over Israel and anointed Saul to be the first king over Israel, where their form of government changed from theocracy, which is God ruling over the people, to a monarchy. Now, the theocracy was not successful simply because the people of God would not submit, or the people would not submit to God's rule. In the book of Judges, we find a pattern that emerges, a very tragic pattern that is during the time when they were blessed, at ease, without war, they would then turn to other gods and begin worship of Baal, Ashtoreth, and various gods of the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites. Thank you. Just keep counting on you. Hevites, Hittites, and Jebusites, the people of the land in which they were dwelling. And because of their apostasy God would give them over to the hands of their enemies, and they would be oppressed by their enemies. So apostasy, synonyms are treachery, faithlessness, disloyalty, betrayal, defection, desertion, and heresy. You know, that is what Israel as a group did. You know, and that's what God punished them for. So being oppressed by their enemies, they would cry out unto the Lord, and the Lord would raise up a judge to be deliverer, and they would be delivered from the oppression of their enemies. Then they would have a period of prosperity. The judge would die, and back into the same old pattern of turning their backs on God and beginning again to worship Baal and the other gods. And it's a sad, tragic story of failure. Failure of consistency in the worship of God and the honoring of God. And so the story is that of an incomplete victory. Now, God had told them in Deuteronomy, when you come into the land, you're to utterly drive out the inhabitants thereof. You're not to make any covenant of peace with them. You're not to dwell together and try to coexist with them in peaceful terms. Utterly drive them out was God's command. But here is a failure on their part to obey the voice of God. Now, there was no doubt a rationale in their minds. They no doubt thought something like, well, if we allow these people to stay here and on friendly terms, they'll be strengthened by us. We'll be strengthened by them. They can chop our wood. They can grow our crops. They can build our buildings. And we'll just use them. Well, whatever their rationale, it's wrong if it opposes what God has commanded. And that's what they found. Now, many times in our own minds, what God has required or what God has commanded us to do doesn't seem to be in our best interest. You know, there's many times that we question that. It so often seems that we can figure out a better plan. You know, the back of our minds, we think about it, we come up with a different plan, and we're often just as guilty as the children of Israel for not completely obeying the commandments of the Lord because we don't understand why God commanded it. It doesn't make sense to us, but God has a reason for everything that he commands. And whether it makes sense to me or you or us as a society, it doesn't matter. God will always know better than we do. You know that, and so our goal should be to follow his commandments, to follow his lead. But we don't always do that. Now, the command to utterly exterminate the people seems to be harsh. You know, that's what we see through all of this. It seems to be cruel. To utterly drive them out from their land, that seems to be a very cruel command. And it may be that the people just felt, well, that's too harsh. That's too much. And what it did by disobeying God in that is it brought ultimate problems to their children and their children's descendants. It became a perennial problem afterwards because they failed to completely obey the voice of the Lord. J. Vernon McGee writes that the New Scofield Reference Bible gives as a theme of the book of Judges defeat and deliverance. This is unusually appropriate. There is, however, another aspect which this book emphasizes, disappointment. The children of Israel entered the land of promise with high hopes and exuberant expectations. You would expect these people who were delivered out of Egypt, led through the wilderness, and brought into the land with such demonstrations of God's power and direction to attain a high level of living. You know, God led them to the land, to have victory in the land. Such was not the case. They failed and suffered miserably at the defeat and at the hands of their oppressors. God raised up judges to live to deliver his people when they cried out in their misery. The book takes its name from these men who God raised up. The judges exercised their ministry for the most part in a local and restricted area. All of the judges themselves were limited in their capabilities. In fact, each one seemed to have some defect or handicap, which was not a hindrance, but became a positive asset under the sovereign direction of God. None of them were national leaders who appealed to a total nation, as were Moses and Joshua. The record is not continuous in this book, but rather a spotty account of local judges in limited sections of the nation. So let's jump in. Chapter 1, we're doing 1 through 10. So chapter 1, 9 of the 12 tribes are mentioned here in their failure to win a total victory and drive out the enemy. The three not mentioned are Reuben, Issachar, thank you, and Gad. It must be assumed that they likewise failed. Each tribe faced a particular enemy, and at no time was the entire nation engaged in warfare against any particular enemy. The weakness of the tribes is revealed in verse 3 of chapter 1, where Judah called upon Simeon for help in his local situation. Judges 1:3 states, "So Judah said to Simeon his brother, 'Come up with me to my allotted territory, and we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory.' And Simeon went with him." We find in this chapter the list of the tribes that failed to adhere to what God commanded. Verse 19, Judah and Simeon could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland. Verse 21, Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites of Jerusalem. 27, Manasseh did not drive out, nor did Ephraim, Zebulun, that's verse 31, 33, Naphtali, and 34, Dan. So it's this chapter is listing the failure of all of these tribes. Chapter 2 is a report of the sad conditions of the people that eventually required judges to be raised up to deliver them. This chapter outlines the entire book and God's philosophy of human history. The words for judge, judgment, and judged are used 22 times in the book, or in this chapter. The word evil occurs 14 times. The people did evil, and God raised up judges. That's in verse 11 and 16. People did evil because they did not obey God, which is in verse 2 and 17. They did not obey because they did not believe God, verse 20. They did not obey, or this cycle of history that they followed is given in verses 11 through 16. So let's look at chapter 2, 11 through 16. If you turn there. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger, for they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtoreths. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. So he delivered them into the hands of plunderers, who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. Whenever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said and as the Lord had shown to them, and they were greatly distressed. So that pretty much sums it up. the rest of the book in many ways. So in chapter 3, the children of Israel intermarried with Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, among them, and lived among them. That's very important because it's, I'll read it, you won't have to turn back to it, but we read in Deuteronomy 7, 2b through 4, you shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their sons, nor take their daughter for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, so the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. You know, nothing that happened in Judges wasn't told to them before it happened. That's one of those important things. Israel did evil, forgot God, and served Balaam. God delivered them into slavery. Orthanel, the first judge, was raised up to deliver them. His only qualification seemed to be that he was the nephew of Caleb and married his daughter. Ehud, the second judge, was raised up to deliver Israel from the servitude of Eglon, king of Moab. His qualification was being left-handed.
Hey.
Anybody left-handed in here?
Hey.
God can use you. God can use you.
Now that's good news.
Yeah. He can use all of us. So being left-handed enabled him to gain the presence of the king gain the presence of the king without his concealed dagger being discovered. That was it. That being left-handed, and God used him to deliver a nation.
So left-handed people are sneaky.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. We'll move on from that point now.
Make sure your sword is, what you call it, dagger?
Yeah, dagger. Yeah. Dagger. So, yeah.
Oh, God,
I
have a whole list of left-handed complaints.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, God can still use all of you.
Sandy Pope.
Yeah. So, moving on. Shamgar.
The presidents are left-handed.
Yeah, we're moving on now.
Yeah. That's why I threw that out before.
Yeah. So Shamgar was the third judge, who was an expert with an ox goad. He used it as an instrument of war against the Philistines and delivered Israel. Of all the judges, all of the judges had some defect, some odd characteristic or handicap that God used.
Yeah, one of them was a woman.
And one was left-handed.
Yeah. The judges reveal that God can use any man or woman who is willing to be used. And the willing part is the key. Chapter 4, as we move on to that, is Deborah, the fourth judge, as you so aptly pointed out. She was remarkable. She was a remarkable person and a great mother whom God raised up to deliver Israel from Jabin, king of Canaan. Deborah probably was the only judge recorded in the book of Judges to rule over all of Israel. Eli, as well as Samuel, did rule over all of Israel, and that's in Samuel 2:29 through 3:21. But in the book of Judges, Deborah was the only one that ruled over the entire nation. And, you know, her defect of the time, honestly, is the fact that she was a woman, because there were no men to stand up at the time. And so God raised up a woman who had, you know, you look at that culture at that time, you know, the defect, yes, was at that point being a woman. That was not something that was standard or normal, yet God used her in a great way. Because no man was willing to take the lead, Deborah did, and that's in verse 8 of chapter 4. So she pointed out to Barak, the fifth judge, that she would go, but it would not be to his honor. Jael, a woman, slew Sisera, the captain of the Canaan's forces. So, you know, that is an incredible story of, you know, in this chapter of what, you know, Deborah did. And moving on to chapter 5 is the song of victory of Deborah and Barak. So it's a song written very much similar in the, you know, the hymn form of Scripture. The lawlessness of the day caused Deborah to take the lead as a mother for the sake of her children. And that's in verse 6 and 7. Interesting note, God intervenes in the battle with flooding the Kishon River. That's in verses 19 and 22. And an interesting fact, military leaders have called this area the greatest battlefield in the world. Not only did Barak defeat Sisera there, but also Gideon defeated the Mennonites there, which is in Jude 6 through 7. And the Battle of Armageddon will be fought there. That's in Revelation 16 and 17. King Saul died there, 1 Samuel 31. And King Josiah was killed there in a battle he should have never fought, which is in 2 Kings 22. So an important area. So as we move on to chapter 6, verse 1, the children of Israel did evil. This is the reason for their being delivered into the hands of the Midianites. Let's look at chapter 6, verses 7 through 10, if you've got it open there. Yes, 7 through 10, chapter 6. And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel who said, "Thus say the Lord of God Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hands of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppress you, and drove them out before you, and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the other gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice." Gideon was the sixth judge. He was raised up to deliver Israel. All of the judges, as we have indicated already, had some weakness, some defect, or unusual characteristic that God actually exploited in order to deliver his people. Gideon was a coward at heart. His threshing grain in the wine press instead of on the threshing floor, which is what we see in this chapter, the threshing floor was normally on a hilltop. That hilltop would have been in the sight of the Midianites. There we go. Here is where the angel of the Lord, with a note of sarcasm, called him, "Thou mighty man of valor." Gideon pleads his weakness and littleness as an excuse. God equips him and encourages him in his first exploit. So Gideon, the mighty man of valor. Let's look at Judges 6, 11 through 15. "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was Orpheth, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, with his son Gideon, threshing wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." Gideon said to him, "O Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? And where are his miracles, which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us onto the hands of the Midianites." Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hands of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" So he said, "O Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house." So this, I think, is the best example of sarcasm, in my opinion, in the Bible. More importantly, this is one of the best examples of how we often respond to God. God calls us to his work. Our responses often show our weakness of faith rather than our weakness of ability. We must remember the amount of people, the flawed people, the hurting people, the broken people, the weak people that God used for his glory in the Bible. The difference between those great leaders in the Bible and so many believers today is that those people eventually said, "Yes, send me." I know from my own personal experience that it is so incredibly easy to rationalize the no response to God. We can come up with all kinds of reasons. I did before teaching this, as I've said other times when I've taught, you know, that I'm not ready. I'm not good enough. I'm not holy enough. I don't know as much as half of the guys in this room. I had all the excuses when I was being asked to do this. And I rationalized it in my mind absolutely perfectly that my response was going to be no. The doubt we each hold in ourselves does not come from the Lord. Who does that doubt come from?
The evil one. The deceiver.
That's where our doubts come from. And it's so easy to come up with the reason why not to do what God is calling us to do. Because we doubt ourselves. Those doubts are put in by Satan, not by God. Because God uses the weak. So every time we think we're not strong enough to do this, we're just simply not trusting God. Because God will give us that strength. So, on to chapter 7.
Can I make a comment?
You sure can.
You were calling Gideon with sarcasm. "Oh, mighty man of valor." Is that not looking at Gideon in faith through the Spirit?
Yeah.
That's all.
That makes sense. I don't have an answer to it, but it...
No.
Yeah.
I'm just making it...
Yeah, it's... very
God
much so.
God looked at Gideon much different than...
Oh, yeah. God saw who Gideon was. Now I didn't see what you're meaning. Yeah. God saw who Gideon was and saw what Gideon could do...
Look past all
...through
that.
Him... God uses us in ways that we can't even imagine if we're willing.
Yeah, because if he called me a mighty man of valor, I'd go, what?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Who are you talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Must be talking about the guy behind me. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Gideon also acted without a lot of faith because, you know, it wasn't enough that he actually talked to whatever the angel was there and fed food and what.
Yeah.
He came up with a test, you know.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah. Not only did he not believe when the angel said, "Do this," he came up with, "Well, wait a minute. You know, can you do this? Can you show me this?" There was a discussion, an argument through there.
Just once.
Yeah. And God still used him. You know, there was such a lack of faith in that man, and God used him.
That's when we're resting on our own power.
Yeah.
And not looking at who's giving us the power.
Yeah. And it's so easy to do. You know, we crawl into our fear.
Yeah.
And think we can't do that.
Right.
I can't be that. Nobody's going to listen to me. You know, you walk into whatever situation where you need God's guidance and support, and you walk in and do it yourself.
And every single one of the patriarchs, is Abraham, right?
Yeah.
Even though he did leave Ur and did go into the land of promise, he still lied.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah.
About his relationship with his wife.
You know, there's so many human failures in the Bible, and God uses these human failures for his glory, you know. And my gosh, what a promise that is for us, you know, that it's not anything to do with us. It's only with God and whether we're willing.
What a motley crew we are.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You're our leader, Wally.
All right, so moving on to chapter 7. Here's where the choosing of the 300 takes place. Long story, but he had an army of 32,000 that was reduced by ferreting out the fearful and the indifferent. Gideon equipped the remaining, finally, 300 with pitchers, lamps, and trumpets. The tactics of Gideon produced a riot in the army of the Midianites, and victory was Gideon's. So if we look at Judges 7, 1 through 3, God tells Gideon to tell all his soldiers who are afraid to go home. I think this is an important one. Then Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites onto their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hands saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, say, 'Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. Further down in the chapter, but there were still too many. God had already reduced Gideon's army from 32,000 to 10,000. Then he reduced it from 10,000 to 300. He did this because 10,000 were still too many for God's plans and God's purpose. We rarely think that bigness can be a hindrance to the work of God. Yet it is harder to truly rely on God when we have many wonderful resources at our hands. Though it certainly can be done, it's hard to be big, overly confident, or capable, and rely on the Lord." You know, we start feeling that we're all that. We're capable. We can do whatever this thing is. You know, this is probably one of my best examples, this lovely foot, because I got up middle of the night. I was sick. I knew I shouldn't have done what I was doing. I should have stopped and said, "Rosie, you go out. I'm not feeling good." I walked take the dogs out to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and fall down the stairs not feeling well. Had I turned around and said, "Rosie, you need to do this right now. I'm not capable," I would have been fine. But instead, I thought, "I got to push through. I got to do this." And what happens? In my own strength, I failed. You know, perfect example of, you know, in a very small way. But when I should have turned to my wife in this particular situation and said, "Help me," had I done that, nothing would have happened. I wouldn't have been injured. You know, when you blow that up into our lives, that's what God's asking us to do, demanding that we do, is we call on him. We seek his strength. Paul was in danger of being too strong for his own good. Therefore, God brought a weakness into Paul's life so that Paul would keep relying on the Lord's strength and be stronger than ever. Let's look at Corinthians 12, 7 through 10, because I think this is important in this whole story. And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distress, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And I think that, again, spells out this book of these great judges that were weak, that God strengthened and God raised up. So in chapter 8, Israel wanted to make Gideon king, which he refused. And Gideon's answer is notable as we go into the next chapter. Verse 23 of chapter 8, and Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Gideon died, after which Israel again went into base idolatry. In chapter 9, in most records, Abimelech, how do you say that?
Abimelech.
Thank you. I cannot pronounce things. Abimelech, the wicked son of Gideon, is not rated a judge. We are here told by what arts Abimelech got into authority and made himself great. He thrust himself into the government at Shechem, his own city, by basically by cruelty, particularly by the murder of all of his brothers. His mother perhaps had instilled into his mind some towering ambitions of thoughts, and the name of his father gave him, carrying royalty in it, might help to blow up these sparks. And now that he has buried his father, nothing will serve his proud spirit, but he will succeed him in the government of Israel, directly contrary to what his father's will was. For he had declared no son of his should rule over them. He had no call from God to this honor as his father had. Nor was there any present occasion for a judge to deliver Israel as there was when his father advanced. But his own ambition had to be gratified, and his gratification is all that he aimed at. And that's pretty much all of chapter 9 in there. Chapter 10, Tola the seventh judge did basically nothing to record during his tenure in office of 23 years. Jair, the eighth judge, provided 30 donkeys for his 30 sons to ride upon. If he had lived today, they would all have driven BMWs. This shows that Jair was an adulterous man, a man of wealth and prestige. His many sons had fancy transportation in their own territories to rule over. He never took the title of king, but seems through this that he acted like one. Judges 10:6, Israel's sevenfold apostasy. Then the children of Israel did evil in the Lord's sight, and served Baals and the Ashtoreths, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So A, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. This phrase is repeated 7 times in the book of Judges. It shows the evil of Israel was even worse because they did it before the sight of the Lord. And they served the Baals and Ashtoreth. The essence of Israel's sin was that they served other gods. Here, 7 different ethnic and national gods are mentioned that Israel went after in idolatry. Israel was attracted to those other gods, not because of the beauty of an idol or the image, but because of what was associated with the pagan deities. Baal, the weather god, was associated with financial success. Ashtoreth, the god of fertility, was associated with love, sex, and romance. As for the gods of the neighboring nations around them, it was a matter of conforming to the popular culture and doing what everybody else did. Israel's worship of neighboring gods reminds us that the people of God are often in danger of worshiping what the world worships. Perhaps Israel did not consciously forsake God, yet adding the worship of pagan gods to the worship of the true God was to forsake the Lord. It seemed that Israel was willing to worship just about anything except the true God. When a man stops believing in God, he does not believe in nothing. He believes in anything. God's pattern for doing great works among his people is to raise up a man. He could do the work all by himself. God's that powerful. He could send angels to do the work for him. He could use a leaderless mob or a committee. We know how well committees work. Yet God's normal means of operating is to raise up a man. And through that man to do a great work. God uses leaders. Are we to be those leaders? Has God called you or called me to action? Are we hearing him? Are we listening? For me, I studied these chapters and I thought the thoughts that kept coming into my head were God didn't call the righteous, the holy, the best of the best to fulfill his plans. Second, God wants our faith placed solely in him, not in the world, and more importantly, not in ourselves. God wants our faith to be in him. Philippians 4:13 says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. In 1 Peter 4:11, if anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it with the ability God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Amen. We all have a choice, and our choice is whether we place that faith in what God can do with us versus what we can do on our own. That's what I got out of these studies. Mm-hmm.